Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Welcome to The Majority Report and The Nomi Key Show. Our shows are partnering up to do a recap of the Democratic Unconvention and to discuss what's next for the movement. So for the next hour, I am honored to be in Sam's seat from my New York City apartment. And today we have the infamous, the great Noam Chomsky, followed by a wonderful panel. Well, this was the week, a week we will look back on and say that this was the beginning of the end of Donald Trump, hopefully. Just as Joe Biden was getting ready to deliver his speech of his career, blasting through the low expectations Trump had set and laying out why Trump has to go, Steve Bannon was being arrested aboard a $100 million yacht off of the very appropriately named Gold Coast of Connecticut. Arrested by postal agents for profiting off of Donald Trump's great scam. Remember, Mexico was going to pay for the wall? Well, it turns out private Americans kicked in millions to pay for the dreadful wall, and Bannon and his little cronies stole part of it, according to the charges, of course. Which is, by the way, we're brought to you by the gutsy interim U.S. attorney in Manhattan. She is interim because Attorney General Barr forced her old boss for reasons he still hasn't explained out. See, the arc of the universe is long, and it does tend towards justice, but it might just be payback. There is more. Republicans in the Senate joined Democrats in a report saying that Russia did help Trump in the 2016 election. MSNBC must be losing its mind right now with excitement. Someone to go check on Rachel Maddow. So facts do matter. Trump's faux reality is collapsing around him. But if we all stand together, he will be out in just a few weeks, hopefully. But as progressives, it's important for us to say that this is not the election we hoped for or believe is best for the country. Trump must go. Fascism must be stopped. No doubt there. But was it right to move focus on expanding the Democratic vote to its right? This convention doubled down on appeals for what Mayor CIA Pete called future former Republicans. We all see the plan. Build a coalition anchored in the middle so we progressives can't go too far on breaking down corporate power, delivering Medicare for all, launching a Green New Deal. Instead of worrying about future formal Republicans, bless their hearts, I say we go for present working people. Here is a stat that every progressive should post on their wall. In the last presidential election in 2016, the vote for the Democratic ticket by working people, people with incomes under $50,000, shrank dramatically. Obviously, we all want Trump out. But I say we can have it done by getting back to who we are and getting working people back to vote on where it was better, right? Especially in the midst of this pandemic, especially with unions under attack, especially with climate change impacting working people more, especially with an exacerbating housing crisis, especially with these uprisings, especially with the economy on the verge of collapse. We could have done without so many Republicans and instead heard from some of the most amazing union leaders like Sarah Nelson for flight attendants, Mark Diamonstein from postal workers, Bonnie Castillo of the National Nurses Union, or even someone who has spoken at the Democratic Convention before, Randy Weingarten of the American Federation of Teachers. Frankly, focusing on working families, not Republicans, is likely to bring in working Republicans too. Okay, I didn't get the convention that I wanted, but we can still have the election we progressives need, the working people deserve. Let them focus on the middle of the road and bring in those future former Republicans and dead armadillos. Our job is to bring working people back. The turnout of working people will send a message. That will be heard loud and clear in the Biden White House and in the new Congress. Biden did leave that door open wide for us. He said a Biden administration will have four top goals: containing the virus, rebuilding the economy, establishing racial justice, and controlling climate change. That is the progressive agenda. Our challenge is to make sure he really gets that job done. Containing the virus can't just be about a profitable vaccine for drug companies. It must mean a robust system of public health so working people get regular preventative care. Build the economy back better? Of course. That's what we've been saying all along before this crisis. The old economy, with its grotesque inequities, helped create this crisis. Building a better one isn't a slogan to us. It's an urgent necessity. It's life or death. Purging racism from the system can't just be good speeches and taglines. Having our heart in the right place won't do it. We need to break down and defund corporate, legal, political, and government systems and put them back together in a new way. And on climate change, of course, we want good American jobs in clean energy. But it isn't close to enough. We must break our addiction to fossil fuels and fracking and do it fast. Rejoining the Paris Agreement is not enough. The Green New Deal is our compromise. Biden has a duty to go further, and we have a duty in the general to push him further so working people vote. It's not our job to get people to vote. It is his job. We are the working people. And I am not here to tell you how to vote. I won't shame you. But I will urge you to push the Biden campaign and the administration when he is hopefully president. We've seen this movie before. And hopefully after the election, when the Biden White House looks at the voting results, they will see it was working people, not future former Republicans who gave them power and donations. In 2016, Hillary won a pathetic 53% of voters with family income under $50,000. That was down from Barack Obama's 60%. But it is actually even worse than that. In 2000, 47% of the voters had incomes under $50,000. And in 2016, they were only 36% of the electorate. I wish I could say that was because incomes had soared so much that there were just fewer families making under $50,000 a year. But we know that isn't true. Working people are walking away. Biden needs to bring them back urgently in this election and show that the Democratic Party is really the party of the future. Now, we have a terrific show. Up next is the iconic Professor Noam Chomsky. And then later, we have a panel discussion about the movement with Bhaskar Sankara of Jacobin and founder of the progressive list, Nabila Islam. But first, for those of you who don't know, I host the Nomi Key Show. So please check us out, like, subscribe on our channel on YouTube, the Nomi Key Show. And as Dr. Chomsky has stated for years, independent media is critical. So you can also join us on Patreon for as low as $5 a month at patreon.com/the Nomi Key Show. We will see you after this quick break with Dr. Noam Chomsky. Well, welcome back to the Majority Report / the Nomi Key Show. We are partnering up on this show today, doing a recap of the DNC. Before we get to Professor Chomsky, we're dealing with some technical stuff here because obviously everybody is filming from their homes now, so it's not easy. We know the jam. And thanks for your patience with the show. And I hope you got to relearn the Macarena, which I think I know. It was middle school. Let's just talk about a little bit what's going on in the world. If you watched the DNC, at least the night of AOC's speech, there was a bit of controversy over how she only spoke for 60 seconds and why is it that other folks like Michael Bloomberg and Christine Todd Whitman and Congresswoman Molinari, exactly, I'm sure you don't know who they are because they haven't been in office in years, why is it that they were able to speak and she, of course, as a squad member being progressive, was not? And NBC did not report accurately on this because she did not say Joe Biden's name, they called her out for it. And of course, you know, she stands up to to anyone, pretty much. So she called them out and called out their reporting. Matt, do you want to join us to discuss this a little bit? I know we have a clip of Bernie Sanders finally responding to this controversy over how, you know, AOC didn't mention Joe Biden's name.
Yeah, yeah. You want me on video, too. I'll join the video.
Of course I want you on video. Everyone misses you, Matt. Come on.
Give me just a second to join you on video. But yeah, I mean, I thought AOC, I would have gave AOC and, frankly, Ilhan Omar a prime speaking slot if I was in charge of these.
I mean, it was actually ridiculous. It wasn't just that they didn't get spots. Many members of Congress, let's remind everyone, AOC is the youngest woman ever elected to Congress, ever. So you want to talk about the Night of the Women and history, that is history. But also, as I mentioned in my opening, we didn't have any union leaders speak. We had some union members, but we did not have any leaders who have traditionally had spots at the convention, even with Hillary Clinton. So can we roll that quick clip with Bernie and how and what he had to say?
Representative Ocasio-Cortez, should she have been given a longer speaking slot at the convention?
Well, I think there is some confusion about that. And I think the reason for the confusion has to do with the DNC and it has to do with the media. So let me tell you what happened, because it's not complicated. Bob, as you are well aware, at conventions, people who ran for president, who received a certain minimal number of votes, are entitled to have their name brought forth and have their delegates vote for them. You know, I won a number of states in this Democratic primary. And the people who supported me have a right to say, well, you know, I voted for Bernie Sanders. And that's all that we, this is kind of perfunctory. This is what is done in every convention. It's done in normal Republican conventions, Democratic conventions. I asked Alexandria, we were told by the Biden campaign, which was fine, that you'll have 2 1-minute slots, one to nominate you and one to second you. And we had Bob King, who's the former president of the United Automobile Workers, one of the, you know, great unions in this country, from Michigan. Bob nominated me, and Alexandria seconded me. And I think what the DNC was saying is, oh, you know, she's speaking. No, I mean, they didn't invite her. I think they should have. That's a whole other story. They should have invited
What's the story there?
Well, I mean, the story is they should have had more progressive speaking, giving them speaking spots. But this was just a perfunctory nomination and seconding of me, of which there was 1 minute. That's it. And she was accused of not, you know, saying she supported Biden. She was nominating me. She is, of course, supporting Biden. So I think the confusion there rests with, I think, what the DNC was saying, and certainly media not understanding what happens at a convention.
I totally get that, Senator, but it's also a choice to give her that 1 minute nominating speech versus seven minutes.
Yeah, that's right. I gave her the 1 minute. And that was my choice.
Okay.
I love how it's like presented by AT&T Business.
Okay. Yeah, I know. That's the most dystopian thing about this. It's just covered in ads. But
exactly. So this is infuriating to me because I know that Bob Costa knows how the DNC works. A lot of reporters don't. A lot of reporters are covering the drama of the day. They're covering, you know, the horse race, whatever it is. I think the big issue here is that they're using the fact that, like, the rules are complicated to set Bernie Sanders up. And I think this is a perfect example of manufactured. This is exactly what Noam Chomsky talks about. So, with that, we do have Professor Chomsky. Thank goodness we figured out the technology here. So just let me know when he goes up next, because I think...
here he comes. He'll join us now.
Thanks, Matt.
Yep. And he's connected to audio, and we should have the video shortly, hopefully.
Great.
Professor Chomsky, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Aha.
Can you...
We can hear you?
We can hear you, but not see you.
Okay.
Perfect. Excellent.
Oh, there he is. Hello, Dr. Chomsky. It's nice to see you.
Am I in the screen? I can't tell.
You look great. You sound great. And you're okay. In Tucson, which I was for the last 5 months. So, Dr. Chomsky, thank you for joining us on the Nomi Key Show, which is being aired. Let's get it really confusing here on the Majority Report. We're doing a special co-show today. So thank you for joining us for this special.
Glad to be here.
We just showed a clip of Senator Bernie Sanders talking with Bob Costa from Washington Post, and he was discussing how Senator Sanders, when he was nominated at the convention by AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she was called out by NBC News for not saying Joe Biden's name. And it illustrated an example of how NBC, which does know the DNC's rules of nomination, tried to use the fact that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did not say Joe Biden's name at the convention against her. And we were just discussing right beforehand, this is a perfect illustration of manufacturing consent, in which the corporate media surely knows how the DNC conventions work, if they know anything. But they still wanted to pit progressives against centrists. So what do you think of that, just from the start?
Well, there's a clear conflict between the Democratic Convention, between the DNC, the Democratic National Council, and the liberal constituency. You can see it in the debates over the program.
Click the blue Add to Chrome button, then click Add Extension to continue.
Uh-oh, we have a little technical.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
We had a little bit of a technical glitch there. Go ahead, keep going.
Technical problem.
There's a pop-up sound, but I think it passed now.
I think so, yeah. It's what happens when we're doing this from home. So you're saying that there was a there is a clear divide right now between the progressives and the centrists.
Very clearly in the program. So, for example, even between Biden and the DNC. So Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, both of them, each of them separately, said that they wanted to end subsidies for fossil fuel companies. That was part of the Democratic Party program. When the DNC management saw it, they cut it out. They're thinking about donors in fossil fuel donors in Pennsylvania and Ohio. So they cut out the program of their own nominee, not just Sanders and AOC, Biden and Harris. They cut it out at the last minute.
And they did it behind closed doors, which, it happened behind the scenes. It didn't happen with a vote. It surely didn't happen in front of any cameras. And it also happened while everybody was paying attention to this I guess, well-crafted convention. So, I mean, I guess what we're trying to figure out right now is if Joe Biden is elected and he takes office, and effectively he will take over the Democratic National Committee, are progressives going to be in worse shape in that the Democratic establishment, in terms of the movement pushing forward, the Democratic establishment will have the reins again? It's not like we're going to have an election over DNC chair anymore. Suddenly it will be Joe Biden's party. Center for American Progress will be in power again. All of the institutions that surround. How do you see this playing out?
It's very hard to say. There's not only a Democrat-Republican conflict. There's a conflict internal to the Democratic Party between the Clinton New Democrats, donor-oriented, Wall Street-oriented, and the base of the party, which is basically social democratic, wants to move on issues like health care, ending fossil fuels, so on. That's a conflict. Same one in the Labour Party in England. In fact, what you saw in England was a real power play when the Parliamentary Labour Party, the Blair Party, along with the media, mass media almost uniformly, really destroyed the Popular Labour Party. They destroyed Corbyn, who had turned the Labour Party into a participatory party with mass popular involvement. They couldn't take that. They killed it. If you take a look at that 800-page report that came out on shenanigans inside the Labor Party. You can see the extent to which they went to destroy the threat of a popular-based Labor Party. They wouldn't tolerate that, and they managed to destroy it, basically. And I think we're seeing something of the same conflict here. So, for example, the DNC, where they control the states, were able to purge Sanders voters in 2016. They probably did it this time, too. We haven't got the figures yet. But now we see it even more sharply, because it's even between the Clintonite DNC establishment and their own candidate. One of them, actually, but went a little too far in threatening the donor class.
Professor Chomsky,
about American elections. Mm-hmm. American elections are bought. You can predict the outcome of an election for Congress or president with remarkable precision by just looking at campaign funding. Thomas Ferguson, well-known political scientist, has studied this over a century, and it's remarkably predictable. You have to laugh when people talk about Russian influence in the election, which is undetectable.
Right.
And what is not only detectable but overwhelming is simply the funding of elections by the corporate sector and private wealth. There is an overwhelming effect.
You know, over the last 45 years since the New Democrats and New Labor and really the consolidation of media, it's been very hard for progressives to build a boom. And of course, it's all broken apart with the internet and income inequality soaring, you know, all the movements that have grown in the last decade or so. So have you been surprised by how long the New Dems, the New Labor have been able to stay around, you know, the Bill Clintons of the world maintaining their power well after their presidency and control of the White House and the party?
They've pretty much controlled the same basic group as largely controlled the government since the country was founded. That's taking different forms at different times. Now, when there is an enormous popular upsurge of the kind that took place, say, in the 1930s, when the labor movement revitalized massive strikes, sit-down strikes, and popular parties storming, demanding change, and a sympathetic administration, they yielded to their pressures, and you got the New Deal, and the United States moved to a mild level of social democracy.
Mm-hmm.
To recognize how remote the United States is from the major developed societies. So take the Sanders program, which is called in the press radical left. Okay, this is a radical left program. Two main planks. One is universal health care. Can you think of another society that has universal health care? Can you think of one that doesn't have it?
Exactly.
But that's radical left in the United States. Really scary. The other major plank, there are only two, is free college tuition. It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But the call for what's everywhere in the United States is radical left. You have articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post saying, you know, maybe it's a good idea, but Americans just aren't ready for these radical left proposals that you have in every other country in the world. I mean, that's a sign of business power, enormous business power. Now, is the public opposed to universal health care? Of course not.
Right.
Take a look at, in fact, what happens when it comes up on the ballot. Is very interesting. So I lived most of my life in Massachusetts, the most liberal state. Universal health care regularly came up on the state ballot, on the state for a referendum in the state. Polls showed overwhelming support for it. Then you start getting the flood of ads. They're going to take your doctor away from you. Mm-hmm. You're going to have such huge taxes, you won't be able to buy food. You know, pouring in, you know, nice couples like Harry and Louise talking about how terrible our lives will be when we won't be able to see a doctor and the state will be controlling us and so on. You watch the polls, the numbers decline. And finally, it gets to a vote, it's voted down. That's business power. And you're not going to confront it inside the government. Only way you can confront it is by making people's power greater. Worked pretty well in England. 2017, Corbyn swept the elections, biggest vote that Labour had ever gotten. 2 years later, they killed him with a massive campaign claiming anti-Semitism. Right. You know, somebody said a critical word about Israel, their Nazis and so on. And it was all over the media, all the way to the Guardian, you know, the critical media.
Right.
And he's not a fighter. He just stood there and took the battering, and there was no answer. And that was it. You're seeing another version of it now. And until there is a energized, active, engaged popular movement, it's going to be hard to combat. If Thatcher and Reagan or their advisors knew exactly what they were doing when they came into office. First thing they did when they came into office, both of them, was crush the labor movement. Mm. That's critical. As long as you don't have an engaged labor movement, there isn't going to be a solid continuing base for progressive programs. So it's very important to kill the labor movement. Now, this was done, as Thatcher did it, by smashing the coal mine strikes. And Reagan did it right away.
Right away.
By bringing in scabs, which is illegal in every country in the world except South Africa at the time, bringing in scabs to break up strikes. As soon as the government did it, the corporations got the idea, they started doing it. Pretty soon you have what you have now, practically no labor movement. Then, of course, you have the courts, which are business run, of course, which institute what are called right to work laws.
Mm-hmm.
Right to work means right to steal. It means that a worker in a union can say, I want union protection, but I'm not going to pay dues.
Mm-hmm.
That's right to work. It takes real good propaganda to put this.
You're in Arizona, which is a right to work state right now. And if you look at the map back to the Reagan era and before, so much of this was empowered by the Koch brothers, which you know too well. And I think what's so interesting about their strategy is clearly the Republican Party demographics were shifting away from them. They had to start appealing to new voters or taking control of the power. So whether it's, you know, through actual challenging of incumbents or controlling the media, astroturfing, lobbying, redistricting, of course, later on. It seems like the Democrats, the new Democrats, the establishment Democrats, are operating with the same tactics right now against progressives, because the demographics are not in their favor, clearly. I mean, the ideas of Senator Sanders, the ideas of AOC and the Squad and so many other progressives that are now rising into power are really reflective of a generation of, you know, millennials and below, and of course, you know, working people who haven't been coming to the polls at the rate needing to win. So knowing that there's all this power around us, you have monopolized media, you know, barely any investigative reporters left, barely any statehouse reporters left. You know, the parties that are extremely concentrated towards corporate power. How can the progressive left, so many of who are new to this movement because they're younger, really fight off and not fall for the same tactics that they can fight back against moving forward? I mean, what tips would you have for younger people who are now part of this movement?
Keep at it. They've already had successes. Now, the you know, the program of the Biden program was compelled by popular activism mm-hmm. to move farther towards what's called the left, mild social democracy, than any previous program since mm-hmm. Roosevelt. And it was done by constant activism. So, for example, on the most important issue of all, doing something about environmental catastrophe, party didn't go far enough, but went way beyond the Clintonites, way beyond. The DNC didn't like it, but were forced to accept it. The program calls for $2 trillion of investment in something like a Green New Deal. It supports a Green New Deal, which is essential for survival. And it even called for advancing the date for net emission neutrality. Okay. Now, the next thing will be to see if they'll do it. It's one thing to put it on paper. It's another thing to implement. They're not going to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. They'll only do it if the same forces that made them write it on paper will keep their feet to the fire and make them implement it. And that's what young people can do, keep banging at the doors. How did a Green New Deal ever make it to the legislative agenda? Okay. Sunrise Movement.
Right.
Group of young people who were not only agitating, but went to the point of taking over congressional offices, Nancy Pelosi's office. Now, they got support from AOC, other young legislators that came in on the Sanders wave. Now, there was a progressive Democratic senior senator, Ed Markey, he joined in, mm-hmm. and they managed to put it on the legislative agenda. Now, the Democratic Party nominees have been compelled to accept it. DNC doesn't want it. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens. But that's the answer. Real politics is not pushing a lever once every 4 years.
Right.
That's what they try to tell you. The standard view of politics is take the leading public intellectual of the 20th century, Walter Lippmann, liberal. Wood Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, liberal, one of the major writers on political philosophy. His position was supported by many others, is the population are spectators, not participants. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to show up every couple of years, push a button, go home, let other people run things for them. That's the line. It's also the corporate line. Mm-hmm. Corporations are concerned, not just the DNC. Corporations are concerned with what they call reputational risk. They're starting to hate us. We're in trouble. Actually, domination is very thin. It's only by consent. People withdraw consent, the whole thing collapses. And they know it. And so you take a look at the Davos meeting last January. It's very interesting. Every January, as you know, the rich and powerful gather at a fancy ski resort in Switzerland, Davos, and congratulate each other on how marvelous they are. CEOs, Hollywood stars, media figures, and so on, go skiing. This year was different. Mm-hmm. The theme this year was, they're coming after us. Mm-hmm. We're facing reputational risk. We got to do something. So the line that they projected was, we've been doing wrong things. We know it the last 40 years. We haven't been working for you the way we should be. But now we're reformed. We realize we made mistakes. We apologize. Now we're dedicated humanists. You can put your faith in our hands. We'll take care of you. We hear this periodically. In the 1950s, it was, we're going to be soulful corporations. Not just for money, but we're going to be soulful corporations. Well, we had 60 years of that. Now we're going to be deeply humanitarian corporations. So just go home, put your faith in us, mm-hmm. and push the lever, go home, these spectators, not participants, and we'll make sure that everything works properly for you because we're so dedicated to your welfare. Well, people can either accept that or not. Mm-hmm. If you don't accept it, keep hammering away, you make progress. That's how every positive change has ever taken place. The power doesn't give you gifts.
Right.
They grant you something that they're forced to.
Right.
When it's taken, when they can't have an alternative. J.P. Morgan Chase, biggest bank in the United States, a leaked memo appeared, a secret internal memo, a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was warning that they have to stop their funding of fossil fuels because it's causing reputational risks. People are going to withdraw. Okay, that's the answer.
Yeah.
Until you manage to dismantle the system. It's a system that shouldn't exist.
That's right.
But we're not going to dismantle it by snapping a fist. It's going to take a lot of work.
Right.
Meanwhile, you can force it to accommodate your needs. Just as social democracy developed in Europe, just as the New Deal developed here, just as civil rights developed and women's rights, the environmental movement, anti-war movement, anything you can think of.
So, Professor Chomsky, before we wrap up, you were part of this letter that was addressing free speech. And it was, I think, interpreted in the public as a letter fighting back against what was now called cancel culture. And I'm curious because I know you've had asked this, answer this question a lot, but cancel culture or the attack against folks for, you know, transgressions, past transgressions, apologized transgressions, or nothing at all, just plain old smears. It seems to have become a weapon of the powerful. I guess it's always been, but we're seeing it especially in this election. You know, Alex Moore's campaign in Massachusetts right now against Neil, Representative Neil, and we see it with Shahid Buttar against Nancy Pelosi. There are many, many other races where they're using cancel culture, quote, to break apart, you know, campaigns, the momentum that they're gaining. Is this new?
Well, what's happened is that segments of the left have taken up the standard procedures of the mainstream establishment, which are never discussed because they're just what you do to the left, you repress it. But segments of the left have picked it up. It's wrong in principle. It's tactically ridiculous. It's a gift to the right wing. If somebody comes to campus who you don't like, say Charles Murray, and you break up his meeting, that's a gift to him and to the right wing.
Right.
They love it. They can then portray themselves as the good guys who are standing up for freedom of speech against these radical thugs who want to destroy everything. So if you want to commit suicide, it's a perfect tactic. What you should do if somebody comes to campus who you don't like is organize a meeting in which you discuss, you bring people together, expose who it is, what the background is, what we should do about it. That drives them off campus in embarrassment because it's kind of like reputational risk.
Right.
That's the way you do it, and it's an educational achievement. Now, it's a lot easier to go into a meeting and scream than to take a constructive educational approach like a radical activist would. But just because it's easy doesn't mean it's right. It's kind of like saying, I'm against the establishment, so I'll break a window on Main Street. That's which happens. You know?
Yeah.
To the Weather Underground, we're seeing some of it now. Gift to the right wing. That's basically what the letter was about. Actually, it was kind of amazing that there was any reaction at all to the letter, because if you read it, it's so mild.
Yeah.
There's almost nothing. Should have just been a slight tap on the wrist. Nobody should have noticed it. the reaction shows that there really is a problem.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. It really pushed people from all sides, whatever, you know, the far right, the centrists, even the left. And it was, yeah, I think that's exactly it. It shows that there's a real problem. Dr. Chomsky, I wish we could sit down and talk for hours. Hopefully we'll be able to do so in Tucson in the future. I'm an alma mater of University of Arizona, so I wish I was able to be taught by you. But Professor Chomsky, it's been an honor having you on. Thank you for your commitment for teaching us, and we hope to have you on again soon. Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks. Take care.
Sorry, we have to leave.
Me too. Take care. All right, guys, up next, we have a great panel with Bhaskar Sankara and Nabila Islam to discuss some of the ideas that Professor Chomsky mentioned. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Nomi Key Show / The Majority Report. We're in partnership today covering the DNC, the wrap-up from the week, where the movement goes from here, whether Joe Biden is our president or Donald Trump remains and fascism basically takes over. We have a great panel. We have Bhaskar Sankara and Nabila Islam. Are they coming in? Are they ready to go? All right. Technology, it's working today. Hello, hello.
Hey, Bhaskar, how are you?
Bhaskar is here. Great, Bhaskar. Thanks for joining us. Bhaskar Sankara is, of course, the founder of Jacobin, editor-in-chief,
you know,
master
actually,
of all.
I caught the end of the Chomsky interview on the YouTube, and I saw the greatest interlude music and video ever. I mean, I don't know if that was Matt's work or your work or who was responsible for that, but that deserves some sort of daytime Emmy or something.
Thank you. I knew about it. I'm a convention junkie, and it's kind of been making the rounds. But Bhaskar, let's just start off with the big question here. Where do we go? What are our next steps as a movement from now until Election Day? And then if, hopefully, I can't believe I'm even saying that, Joe Biden is elected president.
Well, I think to begin with, it's worth saying that, you know, we're in an incredibly constrained situation on the left by virtue of things beyond our control, the U.S. political system, the fact that even though we seem to have at the very least 30, 35, maybe more of the population behind us as a coalition, and many more when it comes to policy preferences, Medicare for All, a jobs program, and so on, we don't really have that much political power. So we need to be thinking in slower terms about how we build that long-term opposition. Mm-hmm. And that means in the short term, we won't really be writing policies, but we'll be changing the conditions in which policy is written. And the delicate balancing act is, how do we form this radical opposition without alienating many working class people who rightly see Biden as a lesser evil for than over, you know, Trump. And I myself do not advocate the socialist canvas or go out and expend our finite institutional resources for Biden. I think we'd be much better off campaigning for things like Medicare for All, pressuring and primarying bad incumbent Democrats and replacing them with people who might actually be worth galvanizing and turning people out to vote in the ballot box. I think that this strategy does not help Trump, but it does help build our independent, distinct political profile, fighting for things in the interests of working class people. And besides for that, I mean, we need to just think about where we were 5 years ago and the fact that we're not where we want to be, but we've made tremendous progress. And if we really think in strategic terms, if we think about exploiting the electoral opportunities and the social movement opportunities we have, you know, we're going to be in a much better place in 2025. And at that point, we might actually be able to take over the Democratic Party, or at the very least to push it from the outside and realign it into something that actually does represent the interests of working people and isn't just the lesser of two evils.
Well said. Nabila Islam, she just joined us. She recently ran for Congress in Georgia in a red district. Was, I believe, the closest district in last election in which a Democrat won. You came so close to making the runoff, but she got right to work, and she started an organization called Progressive List. You're the national organizing director for Matriarch, which is an organization that supports working-class women running for Congress. So, Nabila, I mean, you are very strategic about this in terms of what Bhaskar just said, operationalizing this movement and really hitting on, I'd say, key power pressure points, whether it's challenging incumbents or you know, really running progressives in even conservative districts that we thought were unthinkable because that's what the Democrats told us. So Nabila, I mean, what do you think is next for us? What's the first policy item you think we should be focusing on if Joe Biden takes the presidency, assumes the presidency?
Well, I think we should be focused on a couple of things. Mainly, we need to be operationalizing the left. Right now, the main talking point I hear from moderates is, you know, the moderates won back the House. And that's because, you know, we didn't have institutions on our side to help uplift progressive candidates, and which is why I'm now the founder of an organization that's going to help progressives from the beginning when they really need the push and the money and the resources. And I really feel like right now, I know that for progressives, Biden was an ideal. And I think I caught the tail end of what you were saying, in terms of, you know, if we elect him, we're going to have time to organize. He's not going to seek a second term. So we'll have the ability to put a strong candidate, a progressive candidate, in 2024 to run for office, probably prior to that to actually run. But I mean, I think, look, we should be able to push him on Medicare for All. I know he said he wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't sign a bill if it came to his desk. But I think in light of everything that's happened, we should be able to keep pushing him.
Okay, so there's this thing happening right now with the Democrats, though, and I asked this question to Dr. Chomsky earlier, is that, you know, there is a concentration of power happening. They're all what used to be the if you can even believe it, the Obama wing and the Clinton wing. They used to spar. You know, they united under Clinton. The DNC has effectively pushed out any progressives or dissent out of the party, out of any of the decision making in the party. The media coalesced behind Biden right after South Carolina. They're flexing their muscles, right? And even further, they're actually up. You know, we saw with Alex Moore's situation. They're smear campaigns. The ones that we see, you know, that was leaked. I'm sure, I have no doubt, actually, that this is happening all across the board with a lot of progressive candidates where they'll find folks to, like, join DSA and, like, you know, put out, create some sort of dissent or questions about a progressive candidate based on purity or cancel culture or nothing. So Bhaskar, I mean, you, both of you actually, but Bhaskar in particular, like you've studied these social movements for decades across the world. This is not a new thing, but this is it's a younger movement in this country. A lot of Zoomers, a lot of millennials who really are learning as we go. What can we learn in terms of fighting back and staying focused? What can we learn from previous movements in which this has derailed? As Chomsky said, you know, the UK labor movement is a perfect example.
Well, I think the first principle is to assume good faith. Assume that if somebody's in the room saying that they're fighting for things, that they actually believe it. And obviously, if someone behaves improperly, if they take the wrong position, if they're personally, you know, hostile or doing bad acts or whatnot, obviously you try to correct that behavior. But I think assuming good faith is the foundation block for solidarity or for any sort of movement. It's how we prevent agent provocateurs or people who are just plain, you know, idiots and not even, you know, if anything, you could probably be more forgiving of agent provocateurs because they actually have a mission and they're trying to the same way when Nancy Pelosi is opposing candidates that we support, or she's on the warpath against us, or certain parts of the establishment media are against us. Well, that makes sense in ideological terms, right? It wouldn't really make sense if they were just laying down and letting us primary them, or they were just laying down and letting us reshape a political discourse that's fundamentally not in their class interests and not in their own personal political interests. So I think a lot of these fights that seem unfair, that seem dirty, are perfectly fair in the grand scheme of politics. And we need to just be aware, though, of separating the base of the Democratic Party from a lot of the leaders that they'll vote for. You know, my parents, like many brown people in America, are loyal Democratic Party voters. They also love Bernie. So they love the Clintons and they love Bernie. And that's something that doesn't exist on Twitter, but it does exist in the real world. And they love Bernie because he's an honest guy, they think. He says what he thinks. They like his demeanor. They like Medicare for All. And they also particularly have no great animus for Nancy Pelosi. And they think that, you know, she's a woman fighting Donald Trump. And that's the little sound bites of media. Like, I don't even think they read the newspaper. Just like sound bites that they pick up on CNN or MSNBC and whatnot. And we need to, in other words, make our distinct policy profile, explain how we're different than establishment Democrats, but do it to win over a lot of the people, particularly the multiracial working class base that is still voting for a lot of Democrats. Now, the ones that aren't staying at home but are actually voting, we need to win over those people too. And that means a level of tone that's able to convince and persuade, even while we're uncompromising to those establishment leaders and the pundits behind them. It's kind of this delicate balancing act, but it's really important for doing mass politics and not sectarian politics. And that's the evolution of our movement in the next few years. We need to keep going from the margin into the mainstream without diluting our program. We need to mainstream our program.
Nabila?
I had an idea. I'm sure many people have thought about this too, but as far as, you know, there's a lot of politics in politics. And so the establishment, you know, plays every trick that they can. But I'm pretty sure Tom Perez is probably not going to run for another 4 years at the DNC. Why not have a progressive candidate run to be chairman or chairwoman of the DNC and, you know, take a piece of that electoral power away from them so that we have a voice at the table? Look, Keith Ellison almost won his first round. And in the second round, he had some people make some phone calls and he unfortunately did not make it. But I think that we can grow our electoral power in the next 4 years through Congress by, you know, attacking seats that where you have incumbents that with low name recognition. Mm-hmm. Our candidates are interesting. They're transformational. They don't need the most money. They just need enough money. And we just saw what happened this cycle. Like, the people are excited about progressive candidates. And if we can get them the resources to be competitive, I don't see why we don't have a bigger sweep come next cycle, midterm. So I'm excited in terms of our growing power.
And it's interesting you say about the DNC, because the first election for DNC chair happened after 2016. So maybe that's something that we demand, that's the norm now. Okay, so just rapid round right now before we wrap up. I wish this panel could go on for another half hour. I have so many questions. I guess the question is our leverage. I really think that the progressive left, you know, there's a lot of power, there's a lot of energy, but where is our leverage now? Bhaskar.
Well, I think that I know this is a very predictable answer from a socialist, and especially for people who know my work, but I think that our leverage is still largely in our workplaces. And that's such an important element that we shouldn't underestimate. Even organized labor, which of course is only 8-9% of the population, is still the largest single progressive bloc in the country, and it has the most strategic weight. You know, 10,000 longshore workers on the West Coast can shut down the nation's economy behind demands.
Right.
We've seen when it comes to even retail workers, just 1.3 million retail workers were able to bring about restrictions from places like Target to even non-union shops like Walmart, mass, you know, restrictions and other things that have saved lives of not only retail workers, but customers as well. And I think getting organized labor behind more insurgent candidates, getting those activists really involved with struggles like Medicare for All. I think the Postal Workers Union is a great example, APWU, of a union that backed Bernie, backed Medicare for All, backed that agenda, but is also able to really galvanize its members behind both shop floor interests, but these broader social causes as well. You know, I think that's a really important spot for us to break off organized labor from establishment Democrats and to say that, listen, even if you're not 100% behind our program, the only way you get anything is if you have a credible exit option. And in the U.S. political system, it's probably not going to be a third party. So what it is, though, is this new round of anti-establishment primary challenges. So at the very least, even if they're staying neutral in a race, they'll be able to exert more power and leverage and get behind this unified agenda that I think 60% of the country, we can imagine, even in places like the Southwest and others that don't really have deep footholds for progressive politics, can get behind fair trade, Medicare for All, jobs, and good funding for education and childcare. I mean, these are things that can be the bread and butter of a program that wins over a majority in this country. And we need to be really ambitious, even though it's going to take 5-10 years to probably get there.
Great. Nabila. Leverage.
So I think all politics is local. What I've seen in Georgia especially is that the progressive movement is it's growing at the local level. Our voices are being heard more and more. And I feel that, our elected officials are listening. And so not only that, we're seeing more candidates at the local level, you know, putting themselves, at the table to run for office. So I think it's very important that we continue to have our voices heard on the campaign trail, making sure that we're, constantly, being on, in the media, talking about what's important to us, what the policies that we need to actually uplift our communities. And so I think it's so important that we continue to run for office, not just at the federal level, but the state and the local level, and continue to grow our voices from there.
Great. Thank you guys so much, Bhaskar Sankara, Nabila Islam. You're a joy. I'd love to have you back on soon on my show, on my channel. We're here on the Majority Report channel. Thank you to everybody for joining us today. Thank you to Sam Cedar for giving me his seat in my apartment. You can join us on The Nomi Key Show on YouTube, also at patreon.com/The Nomi Key Show. Next week at 3 p.m., just after The Majority Report, we're going to be covering the RNC, but we're going to do it in a different way. We're going to talk about a lot of the attacks that the Republicans are making against working people. We're going to have a Labor Day. We're going to have a day where we talk about redistricting and all of the tactics and dirty tricks that they do, so that we're well-equipped for when Joe Biden hopefully becomes president, or if he does not, how we move forward and fight fascism. And next up, there is an interview between Sam Cedar and John Benjamin. So make sure to stick around for that. It's a special one. Always love watching those. And thank you to everybody for joining us. Thanks to Bhaskar. Thanks to Nabila. Thank you to Professor Chomsky, Matt, Brendan, Kyle, Dorsey, Ruthie, our team at The Nomi Key Show. It's been a pleasure. Hope to see you next week.
Hi, Sam Cedar here of the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. Next up, we have a guest. We're going to play a clip of the trailer for his new album. I had booked this because I thought that the album was going to be something different than it was. We've had this guest on before. He's People know him as a voice actor. And, of course, probably his most prominent position is he is the voice of the Majority Report. His name is John Benjamin, or H. John Benjamin. He likes to, because I guess, I don't know, it makes you seem more important if you have an initial in front of your name. But let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll play a clip of his promo for his album. And that is the promotional video from the album John Benjamin Jazz Daredevil, the soundtrack collection.
Sound miffed. Are you mad?
No, I'm not mad. I'm just in the middle of doing your intro. On the phone is John Benjamin, apparently the Jazz Daredevil.
I mean, it just sounded like you... The intro was like filled with disdain.
Well, I don't. It's not a question of disdain. I just found
like you just
video.
Saw something you didn't like, and then you had to do an intro about it after. That's what it sounded like.
Well, all right. I mean, I'm not going to argue with you about that, John. Welcome to the show. I guess.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for that wonderful intro. I really appreciate it.
I usually do better when the guest actually lets me speak when I'm in the middle of the intro, but that's okay.
Well, maybe it would be nice to let guests speak during their intro so that they could comment on how you're introing.
Well, people can do that after I intro, or they can do it on Twitter or other mechanisms.
I guess most people would just move on, but I guess I didn't, so I don't know. That was just a decision I made in the moment.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I respect that.
But that decision was based on the way you were sounding after you watched something that I did.
Maybe there were other things going on in my life today, okay, that are difficult.
Do you want to talk about those?
No, I don't. So, John, you have been on the program before talking about your first album, which
I did. That was a long time ago, but that was in 2015.
Was that in 2015?
Yeah.
Wow, has this thing really been 5 years in the making? Jeez.
Yeah, so the last time that I made an album, you were in your 40s.
That's probably accurate. I think you probably were too, John.
Did you not want me to talk about your age? Because it sounded like you didn't want me to talk about your
age. No, it's just largely irrelevant. My point is that this is your second musical album. Your first album was something to the effect of Jazz Daredevil, I Should Have.
Well,
right?
It was actually
Should've.
Well, I Should Have.
Well, I Should Have. Okay.
Yes. Then an ellipsis, and then an asterisk. And then the asterisk referred to the lower part of the album, which said learned how to play piano.
Right.
So technically the whole title was... well, I should have learned how to play piano.
And that was for your 2015 album, where you actually paid professional jazz musicians to sit in a room and essentially have to endure your playing the piano without any ability to play the piano. I mean, is that an accurate description?
That's one way to frame it. I'm not sure. They were playing the jazz music they always play, and I was playing with them. That would be another way to put it.
And just to round that out, you didn't know how to play the piano, but they were professional musicians.
That's correct. It was my debut jazz album, and I didn't know how to play jazz at that time. Or didn't know how to play the instrument, the piano, at that time. But I did play along with them.
I think one of the things that you just said really actually, you know, is struck with me as I prepared for this interview. And that was, you know, I guess I thought it was 3 years ago, but maybe it was 5 years ago when you did your album.
It was 2015, so I don't know why you're...
Well, whatever. 3 or 5 years ago, it doesn't really matter because... I thought, oh, this will be interesting. I'll check in on John Benjamin Jazz Daredevil. He's done a soundtrack collection. Yep. And his first album was about how he didn't, well, I should have learned to play the piano or whatever it was. Let me play a clip from your next album. This is the theme from Chariots of Fire, which is a beautiful composition. Whenever I hear it, almost ever, whenever I hear it, I can still imagine. Yep. I tear up a little bit because I still recall those British runners running through the beach on some type of British coastline, and it is incredibly moving. And then here is your rendition. We've heard enough.
You get the idea from that.
We get the idea. I'll tell you what the idea is.
Version of Chariots of Fire, the way I can play it.
All right. Yes. The idea is that despite the fact that you've had 5 years to prepare for your second album, when in your first album, you were so aware that you should have learned to play the piano that you called your album that. Five years later, you don't seem to have done anything to learn to play the piano. In fact, I listened to that, and instead of like the beautiful image of the human form running so desperately with so much joy and it across that beach, I see them stumbling. I see them falling and hurting themselves.
You're like really into sports, or
no? It was a beautiful movie. It was incredibly inspiring. It's one of the movies that I think about whenever I'm low or down, and I listen to this theme, in many ways, it ruins it for me.
Well, I mean, my intention was not to ruin the movie. The movie holds up, I guess. I wasn't a big fan of Chariots of Fire, the movie, but I did like the soundtrack. That's why I picked the song, and I tried to play it the best way I could. And there are a lot of differences between the first album and this album, and you point out one thing that just happens to be the same, which is that I did not learn how to play. But I do play now on electronic piano and not on acoustic, so that is a big difference. I made that decision going into it. I picked the music based on that, and so that's a huge difference. And also, I'm doing all covers of soundtracks, which is also different than doing original compositions, which, you know, like, so there are differences.
Right. There are differences. That is true. I also notice here on the
but I guess if your you're album on the one
your
thing.
Album cover is you're no longer wearing a Daredevil outfit. You're wearing an astronaut outfit. I'm not quite sure I understand that.
Well, I think it has something to do with the sci-fi or electronic element that I started.
Chariots of Fire took place in the early 1900s. There was no, we were decades away from any type of space exploration program. I don't even know that people, I mean, surely people could have imagined at that time, but I don't understand.
Yeah, but the soundtrack was not made when the movie took place. That's not how soundtracks work. They're not if you do a period movie like Room with a View,
right.
The music was made contemporary to the making of the movie. They don't pull, they didn't have the soundtrack ready to go from the period in which the movie took place.
Well, I mean, they didn't have soundtracks, probably. I mean, well, maybe they did, probably, at the contemporaneous time in which the movie, the film takes place. But nevertheless, right. I mean, it's thematically, it doesn't make any sense. What's so daredevilish about going to in the space program? It is, it's almost diametrically opposed to that. If it was, it would be horribly irresponsible to send people into space if it was a daredevil mission.
Well, I think every probably space mission is a daredevil mission in a sense. I don't think it has anything to do with my music, but
I think
you keep.
I think people. I'm just making the point because I've got this. This
I get
up
it.
Here.
I think it's like a red herring. I don't understand why you're probably harping on the.
I guess space. I'm just still a little bit upset about the emotional.
It's like being mad. It's like being mad at Madonna for wearing a bustier, I guess, or something.
No.
Yes, because it's like, oh, that was from a different time. That was from, like, the Old West. Why is she wearing that? And why would you, well, it has this music, like a virgin, has nothing to do with the Old West.
Well, certainly, I mean, one could say it has to do with a bustier. I mean, look, but that's not the point, John. The point is that why did you do a soundtrack collection? Like, let's just talk about that. Let's just zero in on that, on that aspect of it. You did a soundtrack. Why a soundtrack? Tell me why soundtracks.
Well, like I said, my jazz interests moved a little bit toward electronic sound and the use of the Moog synthesizer. That's the synthesized piano that I worked with, and soundtracks from when I was, probably in my it was in the 80s, like movies that I appreciated. A lot of the movies were in the 80s on the album. I wanted to do covers, so that's how it came about.
And that is the thing, I guess, that I find interesting about soundtracks, because it's so evocative of films that may be very important to you, that may have hit a chord for you or one at a particular time in their life. Maybe they watched it with someone, like Chariots of Fire. I really have very, very strong visceral associations with that movie
that up until now have been incredibly positive.
It's almost like you're desecrating the film in a way.
Did you have an experience with Chariots of Fire that I don't know about? Like that it's this important to you?
I didn't mean to
ruin a movie for you, but like anything, the music from the movie can be reproduced.
Let's play the theme from Love Story, which is an incredible.
Is this another really important movie in your life, Love Story?
I mean, I think for a lot of people our age, John, Love Story was a seminal
Love
film.
Love Story was made in 1975 or seven, right?
Yeah.
So you would have been what,
10.
Less than 10 years old, and yeah. That was a movie that was important to you?
Yeah, it was one I think that was foundational in my sense of what love meant. Yes, I think the sacrifice and the mutual respect between the two leads mm-hmm. was in many ways like I say, foundational for me and became a model for really, in many ways, what I imagined my
That's what you base all your relationships on? Is love story?
Well, look, as you know, John,
it was a tragedy.
But
yeah.
As you know, I, even at a very young age, was contemplating going to law school in Boston. This is a story about a Harvard law student. I did not get into Harvard, but that's okay. I certainly...
Based on the way you're arguing, I'm not surprised about that.
Well, that's the case. And it was to see Oliver Barrett, who was played by Ryan O'Neill. And
I can tell you just looked it up, so that's good.
I didn't just look it up, John. It's like I say, it's a very
in your head.
Well, I just I remember the movie. It was important to me. Alan McGraw, of course, I had a massive crush on. Let's just.
Did you have the same kind of crush you had on all those runners and in Chariots of Fire, or is it a different kind of crush?
It was a different kind of crush.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've nothing wrong with any kind of crush. I was just asking.
Well, it was different.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Here is your rendition, and I should tell people there's a here's your rendition of Love Story, the theme from Love Story. I guess the good news is we're not going to get a copyright strike because that is indiscernible.
Well, that's how I made the album. I mean, I would have never been able to make the album if I could play. It would have been too expensive.
Because you would have had to license the rights and to actually play the music.
Yeah, but
that doesn't take away from licensing the rights to butcher the music.
That doesn't take away from the artistry of what I did, I don't think.
It certainly doesn't. I don't know how you could take artistry away. I mean, like, you know, what could you possibly take away from the null set, as it were?
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Well, my suggestion is that it doesn't take away from the artistry, because I think, frankly, I think it's a very hard. You'd be very hard pressed to suggest that there's artistry there. I think
I don't know whether you're the the gatekeeper for art. I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, I think this is, you don't have to really be much of a gatekeeper to make an assessment. Like when you take songs that are so evocative and really in many ways sever the relationship between the listener and all of the emotional investment they had in a song, in a film, in this case, because they're soundtracks.
I mean, I've been to your apartment and I've seen your art, and most of it's like motivational posters and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, that's what I choose to motivate myself. One of the other ways I motivate myself is
two cats, and one's like wearing a hat and it says like, "You go, girl," like stuff like that.
Let me tell you something else that used to motivate me, John. It was Axel F. It was the.
It's not as easy as it looks.
Excuse me one second. Here we go. It was Axel F.
So your favorite movies of all times were Chariots of Fire, Love Story, and Axel F.
Beverly Hills Cop was a lot of fun. And I would watch that movie, and sometimes, like, it was just whenever I felt... All right. Please, turn it off.
I mean, honestly, can I just say something? That, I think, is the, like, iconic version now. Like, based on, this is my opinion. It's the version I did. I don't like to, I'm not, like, just bragging. This is not just braggadocio. I think it's, like, actually better than the original version.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at it. It's on YouTube. Mm-hmm. People can go to, they can search John Benjamin Jazz Daredevil, the soundtrack collection. It is via Subtop. It's very, very hard to find, frankly.
Well, I mean, it's not getting the attention that I thought it would have, but music is very subjective.
People can search for it, John Benjamin Jazz Daredevil, the soundtrack collection, and your what you call is now the iconic version
of Axel F.
The theme to Beverly Hills Cop has received just over 1,000 views and two comments. One is, holy cringeworthy, Batman.
Okay. All right. That's all right. That's fine. I get that people might not get it.
Well, how could it both be the new, iconic version and people don't get it?
Van Gogh wasn't famous till after he died, posthumously. His work was not respected. Van Gogh.
I think you're fine. It's Van Gogh.
Well, I pronounce it the way it's supposed to be pronounced, but you go, girl.
John, now apparently Sub Pop Records put this out. They did.
They did put it out. It's out. It's out.
It's available, and it's actually an album that people could buy.
Yes, on orange vinyl. It's a collectible. It is on orange vinyl, and there is my version with the sheet music included of Chariots of Fire. So you can play my version of Chariots of Fire at home if you can play piano. You can play it the way I did it, and there's also a free patch that's on the album if you're interested in patches.
There's a free patch, like a patch,
like you get that. Like you'd stitch on patch that you could put on your car because it's stitch on. So you could put it on like your clothes, or you could stitch it on something that you could put a needle into.
Let's talk about your promo video. People can see that. We will link to that as well on the majority.fm.
Yeah. Not a lot of people watch that one either.
No. It is, I have to say,
like I said, it's ahead of its time a little bit, maybe, so it's not doing as well as I thought it would be.
You know, it depicts you, I'm not going to ruin it, but it depicts you going into a musical practice session. Where exactly was that?
I was in Budapest.
Budapest.
In Hungary. We flew to Budapest where we recorded with a real orchestra, I think 75-piece orchestra, where I entered without them knowing the way I played, and they played along with me. So that was a live session that we recorded.
I wonder if any of those musicians have recovered from that situation. But, John, when was that? When did you shoot that? Little video.
That was pre-pandemic, so it was in January or December of
pre-pandemic. When in fact, actually, COVID-19 was within Europe at that time, and the way that it got to New York was people traveled from Europe to New York, which I believe is where you live.
Yep.
And one of the key vectors for COVID-19 has been music halls that are closed in, where people are exerting efforts in a almost like a soundproof room, John.
Well, that's true. There was not great ventilation in Hungary in the studio. There were a lot of people in one room. But
has it occurred to you that you videotaped inadvertently perhaps the primary vector for the for COVID-19 to reach the United States of America?
I mean, it's an interesting conspiracy theory.
Is it a conspiracy? What's the conspiracy?
I can tell you this. Rudy Giuliani was there at the same time, meeting with what I believe to be the Ukrainian mobsters to gin up some other conspiracy theories within the Trump administration. He was there simultaneously with me. I did not see him. I had nothing to do with that.
How did you know he was there?
I had dinner with him.
So, John, what inspired you to do this?
Well, like I said, I wanted to, for many years, to do a follow-up, and I wanted to explore jazz in a new realm using electronic music. Follow in the footsteps of the great jazz artists who have done so, Miles Davis in particular, I think. I'm not comparing myself to him, but he did do what I did. He went from...
I mean, you are comparing him to you, and I mean,
well,
to be honest with you...
thank you very much, if that's what you're inferring. I appreciate it.
Maybe contrasting is really what you should be doing. I mean, I almost think that, frankly, it's an insult to contrast you with Miles Davis, because it implies that you are similarly situated enough to be contrasted, when in fact it would be like, I don't know.
I mean, if I can be as honest as possible, I did think that maybe if I use a synthesizer or a Moog synthesizer, it might sound a little better than when I first played on acoustic, because acoustic really does expose all your mistakes. And with the synthesizer, I thought that it might do a little better at disguising some of those mistakes, but I'm not sure it did.
Have you heard from any of the
people in the jazz community?
People in the jazz community, I imagine, have already learned their lesson. But in terms of any of the people who actually wrote or composed any of these songs, I imagine it was disturbing for them to see you present this in some form of professional way.
I mean, so far, I haven't heard anything from any of the people who wrote and performed the originals. Not yet. But like I said, it's only been out there a few weeks, and maybe, I don't know, maybe Harold Faltermeyer would want to email me if he's listening to your show.
Well, John, so what's next for you?
Well, I certainly will keep, plugging away at my jazz. Like albums, you wouldn't know this, but they take a long time, and a lot of thought goes into them. So I wouldn't expect another album within the next 5 or 10 years, but
okay,
hopefully, okay, if things go well, I will put out a third album, and continue the canon, I guess, for the fans, all 280 of them.
I am going to mark this down, 2025. We can anticipate your next album. That's very, very exciting, I'm sure.
Yeah, and like I like to say, yes, it is true that I can't play piano, but I do assert that I am the best at not being able to play piano.
Well, and I would also suggest that also includes the electronic organ. John Benjamin, the Jazz Daredevil soundtrack collection is out on Sub Pop. We will put a link to that and to your promo video at majority.fm. Thank you for coming on and
sharing. Thanks, I appreciate it. I'm sorry I made you unhappy, and maybe
you know, it's just I was okay with bringing you on. You know, we are certainly friendly, and to be honest with you, I was looking forward to it. These are a lot of, like I said, movies that were very important to me when I was younger. And in times like these, sometimes it's nice to sort of just, it's like comfort food. And then it's like going down and sitting in front of your favorite comfort food, let's say macaroni and cheese, and finding that the cheese has gone bad, that it's rancid. And so, yes, it threw me off a little bit, but I'm sorry if that came across in this interview. I apologize.
No, I mean, I hope that you go watch Chariots of Fire and have some macaroni and cheese now.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on, John Benjamin.
You're welcome.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know.